For our reading this evening, we're turning to the book of Esther, to chapter 3, continuing our studies in this book that doesn't contain the name of God in its chapters. And yet, as we've already noticed, it is the hidden God, not the God who is in hiding, but the God who is there, revealed in the events and circumstances of the life of the court in this Persian Empire. So we're reading together tonight from chapter 3, and we come now into the main details of the story, the first part of that, of a plot to destroy the Jews. After these events, King Xerxes honored Haman, king of Hammedatha, the Agagite, elevating him and giving him a seat of honor higher than that of all the other nobles. All the royal officials at the king's gate knelt down and paid honor to Haman, for the king had commanded this concerning him. But Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor. Then the royal officials at the king's gate asked Mordecai, "Why do you disobey the king's command?" Day after day they spoke to him, but he refused to comply. Therefore, they told Haman about it, to see whether Mordecai's behavior would be tolerated, for he had told them he was a Jew. When Haman saw that Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor, he was enraged. Yet having learned who Mordecai's people were, he scorned the idea of killing only Mordecai. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes. In the 12th year of King Xerxes, in the first month, the month of Nisan, they cast the pur, that is, the lot, in the presence of Haman, to select a day and month. And the lot fell on the 12th month, the month of Adar. Then Haman said to King Xerxes, "There is a certain people dispersed and scattered among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom, whose customs are different from those of all others, and who do not operate and obey by the king's laws. It is not in the king's best interest to tolerate them. If it pleases the king, let a decree be issued to destroy them. And I will put 10,000 talents of silver into the royal treasury for the men who carry out this business." So the king took his signet ring from his finger and gave it to Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. "Keep the money," the king said to Haman, "and do with the people as you please." Then on the 13th day of the first month, the royal secretaries were summoned. They wrote out in the script of each province and in the language of each people all Haman's orders to the kings, satraps and governors of the various provinces and the nobles of the various peoples. These were written in the name of King Xerxes himself and sealed with his own ring. Dispatches were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with the order to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jews, young and old, women and little children, on a single day, the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. A copy of the text of the edict was to be issued as law in every province and made known to the people of every nationality so that they would be ready for that day. Spurred on by the king's command, the couriers went out and the edict was issued in the citadel of Susa. The king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Susa was bewildered. May the Lord be pleased then to help us as we continue in our studies of this story of Esther. We have already met three of the main characters in the opening two chapters of this book. We have met Xerxes, the Persian emperor. We have met Esther, who becomes the queen. We've also met Mordecai, a relation of hers, who works in the court. There is one more character that we need to meet, and we meet him in the opening verse of chapter 3. This third chapter depicts, firstly, his promotion to a place of influence, and then it also outlines his plot, what he desired to come to pass. Giving a quick outline now of the remaining chapters, chapter 4, we'll see then Mordecai's plan to counteract the decree that is passed by Haman and Xerxes. And then in chapters 5 to 8, we see Esther's plea before the king. She can't come when she likes. There are rules, and there's a particular way in which this is to happen. And it's at the point of risking your life to do so. So we have this plot here of Haman. Next chapter, Mordecai's plan, and then Esther's plea, chapters 5 to 8. But we begin this evening in chapter 3 with Haman's promotion. We read of it there in verses 1 to 4. And there are three clear indications of this progress in terms of this man coming to prominence, greater prominence, increasing prominence. It begins, we read, by the fact that King Xerxes honored Haman, honored him, gave him then a position of influence and authority. Now, some time had elapsed, for we read, after these events, after the wedding celebration of Mordecai, there knowing that his relation Esther had married the king, and also at the same time then knowing that Mordecai as well had uncovered a plot to assassinate Xerxes and had relayed that to Esther, and she had told the king. Time has passed by. Now we know that it was the seventh year of the reign of Xerxes. You read of that in chapter 2 and verse 16, when Esther was presented to Xerxes. And we know from chapter 3 and verse 7, we're now in the 12th year of King Xerxes. So there's a five-year time lapse here. And after these events then, after the marriage, after as well the conspiracy against Xerxes being uncovered and Mordecai revealing it to Esther, then after these events, King Xerxes honors Haman, brings him to a place then of rising influence within the court. Now, having then been honored, the next thing we noticed was that also he was elevated, elevating him and giving him a seat of honor higher than that of all the other nobles. Elevated, given preference then. Already, in one sense, honored, brought to a sphere of influence, but now, in one sense, promoted or given preference. His credit rating, as we would say, was increasingly becoming significant. He was being listened to. He was being turned to for advice and for instruction and for his wisdom and consideration as to what might be best in the context of this great empire over which Xerxes was the ruler. And he also is a man, Xerxes felt, that he could trust and who would help him in the difficulties of running the empire. And then that third element we notice there, having been honored, having been elevated, he was given a seat of honor higher than all the other nobles. That's the third element here. So it's very much perhaps as we might trace the political history or the political background of an individual. They start off, they become a member of parliament, and they serve for a number of years, and then they're offered perhaps a position as a junior cabinet minister. And they begin to appear on the television, and they're giving a little report, perhaps when the main man is on holiday or away on some other important business. And yet then eventually, from the back benches to the cabinet office, eventually promoted to the seat of influence, becomes equivalent to the prime minister of the country. And we notice that this is not something that has come as a result of democracy. This isn't something that the people have considered this man as someone who would help the nation, and he's cut out for this sort of thing, and they're glad to have him. No, it's a king's appointment. In one sense, it's the king's decision. And what we read in verse 2 may indicate to us that although it was the king's decision, perhaps not everybody in the court there in Susa, in the palace, was particularly thrilled with this news. Verse 2 may indicate to us that the nobles and the court officials were not happy with the appointment. Why do we suggest that? Well, verse 2 reads, "All the royal officials at the king's gate knelt down and paid honour to Haman, for the king had commanded this concerning him." It's assumed that Xerxes commanded Haman to be given respect in his new position. Now, usually, if someone has risen to a place of prominence, it usually is because of their ability, because of their credibility, their integrity, their character. And then that is usually recognized by others. And so respect is the natural outcome. You recognize that this person has certain abilities and gifts, and so you have to, even grudgingly perhaps, but you have to respect him. That is usually recognized by others. But to command it, which the king did here, may point to a problem here. Honor was given, but perhaps not freely so. But there was one court official who would not certainly fall into line in this matter. And we read of him here. "Mordecai would not kneel down and pay him honour." And that was the end of it. And whatever would be said to him, and you notice in verses 3 and 4, there is a discussion, there's a daily discussion that's taking place. This disobedience was first of all observed by the other royal officials. Now, they might not have been happy with it. They might have felt that that Haman was an outsider. They might have perhaps felt they'd been overlooked. But they were bowing down to him because the king had commanded it. And if the king commanded it, you did it. But here was a man now who was not prepared to do it. And so the royal officials observed him, first of all, and then we read, began to question him about it. Did you see it there in verse 3? "The royal officials at the king's gate asked Mordecai, 'Why do you disobey the king's command? Why are you, in one sense, going against, a now accepted custom? Why are you putting yourself in a position of jeopardy here? Is it that important to you? Why? What's motivating you? Why are you thinking like this?' Having been observed then, he was given some time, we read in verse 4, because it was day after day they spoke to him, but he refused to comply. And then, at the end, in desperation, they thought, well, this is a test case. What's going on here? Is it right if Mordecai can get away with this? If nothing's being done about it, well, perhaps we could disobey this command as well. So let's put it up as a test case. So who best to refer it to than to the man himself, the man of prominence, the man of influence, the man of sitting in that great seat, Haman. And this is exactly what you read here. So having refused to comply, they told Haman about it, to see whether Mordecai's behavior would be tolerated, for he had told them he was a Jew. So he was eventually reported. They told it to Haman. Now this is interesting, because what we know is this. It wasn't that Haman had noticed this about Mordecai. Haman was in the court. He's in a position of influence. He's got a lot on his mind, doesn't he? He's got to be wise now and careful in advising the king. He wants to keep his position. He's been brought to a place of prominence. Well, we know how slippery and difficult it can be to remain in office. So he's got all the attention given to that. He's not coming into the court. He's not looking round. He's not spying out people and seeing who's there. He knows who he is. He's involved in his work. He's about the tasks and duties of the day. He didn't even know who Mordecai was. And he certainly didn't notice that he wasn't bowing down to him. It hadn't even come into the vision even, into the remit. But as soon as he was told that there was someone who wasn't doing that, it affected him. It's interesting, Haman didn't notice it, but it's reported to him. He's busy as a man of influence, involved in matters of state. Having been told, though, it seems that whenever Haman was in court, he began to notice this man. And it began to occupy him, to occupy his thoughts. It even began to dominate him, so much so that it began to enrage him. Now, this is interesting. It said of a recent survey, if you change your car, say you've been driving a car, and you change your car, meaning you change the model, you change the colour, you change the model, all of a sudden, do you know what you find? You're driving along the road, and you're seeing cars the same colour and the same model as the new one you've bought. And you think, well, isn't that strange? Look at that, I'm driving along. There's another one, look, exactly like our new car. And I went, well, I didn't know there were so many. Before, you had no recognition of it at all. Why? Well, there wasn't a sense of involvement. But as soon as something like that happens in your life, something changed, you're seeing it everywhere. Well, that's exactly what happened. Up until then, Haman was quite happy to go along with it. It wasn't worrying him. Who is he anyway? But now, to realize that this man wasn't bowing down to him, began to enrage him and upset him. You see, he's in prominence. He's in a position of influence. Probably 95-99% of the people are obeying him. But he can't cope with the 1% of disrespectfulness. Oh, and it's upsetting him. Now, it indicates a nature, doesn't it? It indicates pride. It indicates arrogance. It indicates self-absorption. And it began to dominate him and to enrage him, we read. He was enraged. Never noticed him before, but now when he stepped into the palace, his eyes were looking for the man to see, yes, he's not bowing down again. Now, much has been written in the commentaries as to the reason for Mordecai's refusal to bow down. And perhaps you have your own thoughts on this matter, but we need just to spend some time on it this evening. Why did Mordecai not kneel down or pay him honour? Well, was he jealous of the promotion? And was that eating at Mordecai? And so in one sense, because Haman was in position of influence, he couldn't look at him, he couldn't accept him, he wouldn't bow down to him, he wouldn't be respectful to him. Well, I don't think that's a very strong position to take. Others suggest, well, you see, there's reference to the fact that Mordecai was a Jew. So perhaps what it is, Mordecai as a Jew couldn't disobey the second commandment, not to bow down to any idol or to bow down to any creature other than to bow down to the living God. Jehovah, Yahweh, is the only one that he was to worship. So his religion prevented him from doing this. But when you read the Old Testament, you come across examples such as David, who was later to become the king of Israel. An incident takes place. David's in the back of a cave, hiding from King Saul, who's pursuing him. King Saul happens to come into the cave, and while he's there, David gets his sword and cuts off part of the garment of the king. Then King Saul leaves the cave, and then David comes out. And David, having cut off part of the king's robe, feels guilty about that. He shouldn't have touched the Lord's anointed, shouldn't be doing anything in that sense to upset him. He can leave it in God's hands. And this is what we read in 1 Samuel chapter 24, verse 8. David went out of the cave and he called to Saul, "My Lord, the king." And David bowed down and prostrated himself with his face to the ground before the king. Now that's respect. That's honor. It's not worship, but it's respect and honor for the king, for the person in authority, the person whom of God's appointing and God's choosing at that time. Respect and honor is not worship. And we don't have a position, a situation here of Haman being worshipped. He's being honored. He's being respected. Indeed, respect and honor, even indeed Xerxes, the Persian king, did not consider himself as a god to be worshipped, and certainly would not then have commanded such an action to have been performed with regards to another member of the court. Well, if that's the case, how then do we understand this refusal? Why is Mordecai acting like this? Well, we go back to chapter 2 and verse 5 for a moment, to the time when Mordecai was introduced to us. Back in chapter 2, verse 5, we read, "And now there was in the citadel of Susa a Jew of the tribe of Benjamin, named Mordecai, son of Jair, son of Shimei, the son of Kish." A Jew of the tribe of Benjamin named Mordecai. Three ancestors are then mentioned. Now look at the way that Haman is introduced in chapter 3 and verse 1. We didn't comment on this as we were going through his initial promotion. "After these events, King Xerxes honored Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite." Agagite. Now, who was Agag? He's able to trace his lineage back. Haman can say, "Agag was my ancestor." Agag was a king in the days of King Saul. He was the leader of a group, a tribe of people called the Amalekites. Samuel, the prophet, had given instruction to Saul to destroy the Amalekites. You read of the account in 1 Samuel chapter 15. We'll come to that in a moment. But the reason why Samuel said that Saul was to destroy the Amalekites was for this long-running animosity that had existed between Israel and the Amalekites, going back some 400 years prior to when King Saul became king, back to the time when Moses brought the children of Israel out of Egypt, and all the other nations, although perhaps they wouldn't let Israel pass through their land, none of the other nations were involved in fighting or warring or opposing them physically. The only group, the only people who did that were the Amalekites. And you read of the account in Exodus chapter 17. We remember the account well because it's the time when Joshua is in the valley with the sword, and he's fighting with the men, and it is Moses who's up on the hillside with his hands lifted high, praying to God for the success in the battle. And as Moses' hands become tired, so they are raised up and held, one by Aaron and the other by Hur. And that is how the position in the battle is secured. And it's at that event, the battle that's taking place is the battle between the Amalekites and Israel as they're coming out of Egypt on their way to the promised land. Now, go forward 400 years. Samuel has given instruction to King Saul to destroy the Amalekites. And in 1 Samuel 15 verse 8, it tells us that Saul spared Agag, the king, and some of the best of the sheep. And you know the account there of what happened, that Saul, then having done that, Samuel returns, and Samuel says, "You've lost the kingdom. God will raise up another to become king in your place." It cost Saul the kingdom, and Saul was a Benjamite. And Mordecai is a Benjamite. And Haman is an Agagite. Ever since then, there had been tribal enmity between the tribe of Benjamin and the Amalekites. Indeed, they had been sworn enemies, not only for that 500-year period, but the 400 years before that. So the timescale of Moses to Joshua to Esther, Mordecai, and Haman is 900 years. And so Haman's ancestry reveals he was a sworn enemy of the Jews. And it was much more than this was much more than a clash of personalities or a quibbling quarrel between two courtiers. Haman saw that his promotion, his position of influence and prominence, now gave him the opportunity not only to deal with Mordecai, who was enraging him, but also now to avenge the past once and for all by destroying all of Mordecai's people. We see here a picture, really, of this conflict between the powers of darkness and the powers of God. We see something of the conflict that exists between those who love God and trust in him and those who do not, those who follow God and those who do not. And the significance of this is that this plot that we're about to consider now, were it to manifest itself, were it to come to pass, or you could say, well, you know, it's going to affect Mordecai, it's going to perhaps affect Esther, but they're living in Susa, in the palace, in the midst of Persia. You see, what they should have done, this was their problem, this is why they got into difficulty. What they should have done was that when King Cyrus had given the decree that any Jews were able now and willing freely to leave and to go back to Jerusalem and to rebuild the temple and to rebuild the walls, as men like Ezra and Nehemiah were prepared to do. If they'd only gone, they wouldn't have faced this problem. And although perhaps we can feel at one time that both Esther and Mordecai could have been better than they were, and in one sense, although they're recorded here, you can't speak of them as real heroes. God's the hero in all of this. Yet what we're able to say is this: had they not remained there, do you think that the 50,000 or so Jews who'd returned to Jerusalem would have been safe? Well, they wouldn't have been, because although they'd returned to Jerusalem, Jerusalem as a city, as it were, the other areas and the other boundaries and the other nationalities were still under the influence and the control of the Persian Empire. And so this decree going out would mean that this event, this slaughtering, this destroying would take place in all the cities and in all the provinces, even including Israel itself. So that's the promotion. Then from verses 5 on, we have Haman's plot. Haman was certainly a superstitious man. He believed in lucky days. Do you believe in lucky days? Well, there are people who do. They still believe in lucky days, propitious days, days of fortune. He had pur cast, as it's called, lots cast. He would make no important steps with regards to what he was to do without consulting either the stars or the omens of the time. And so this casting of lots that's referred to here, that we have mentioned in terms of casting pur or the casting of lots, that was simply nothing more than perhaps gathering some stones with some numbers on them or perhaps some symbols on them, or some sticks perhaps, and placing them in a jar or perhaps folding them in a garment and then shaking it, and then either perhaps putting your hand in and drawing something out, a bit like a lottery with a number on it. Or perhaps if it was in the garment, then shaking it, something would fall out onto the floor. The lot had been cast. And so there's this greed day when Haman takes this upon himself to cast lots, we need there in verse 7. Selecting a day and selecting a month. Two decisions have to be made as to when this plot can be commenced. The day as well as the month of some important event is determined then in the mind of Haman. He thinks, well, it's a lucky day. That's the time. But it's nearly 12 months off. Never mind, oh, I wish it could have been earlier, but at least that'll be the lucky day. That'll bring it to pass, although it's 12 months off. Although it was a long way off, Haman was content with the date and the month. But here we're reminded of that proverb which we read at the beginning of our service this evening, in Proverbs 16, verse 33. The lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. Here's the hidden God. Even here in the casting of the lots, as Haman and those perhaps who are going to support him in the plot that he's planning are seeking to find the most suitable, propitious, fortunate, lucky day to begin it. It was Yahweh who orders events and timings and occurrences. This would give time for Mordecai and Esther to prepare for a response to this. And it would also give the people throughout the empire, because the decree was to be sent out so that they would know and they could prepare themselves for what was coming. The next stage of the plot was to misrepresent, having then agreed on a date that was suitable. Then Haman, verse 8, speaks to King Xerxes. This is where the spin begins. This is where the misrepresentation begins. He says to Xerxes, there's a certain people dispersed and scattered in the provinces who keep themselves separate, who isolate themselves. It pictures then these people. They're not mentioned by name at this point, but I'm just drawing you to your attention, Xerxes. With all the problems and the troubles you've got, there are a group of people, a certain people. They're disseminated all over the place. They're not like in one place. They're all over the empire, spread out, and you know, they don't integrate. They're antisocial. They're extensively living throughout the empire, but exclusively not being helpful in contributing towards the empire. They were charged with not obeying, you read, the king's law. They have different customs. They don't fit in. They won't amalgamate. They won't accommodate themselves. Now, this was completely wrong. Because even Jeremiah, when the children of Israel were in exile and being taken into exile, he told them, you must settle there. You must marry. You must have children. You must buy land. You must settle there. You must allow this time of judgment to come upon you, this 70-year period. You must give yourself to it. Be hospitable and be good citizens. And this is the principle that we find in the New Testament as well. Even the Apostle Paul talks that we're to honor the king. And we're to pay our taxes. We're to be good citizens. So it's a complete misrepresentation. But here he's on. He's in a position of influence, you see. We immediately see that it's in the previous two chapters with regard to Esther. Well, Esther complied with all the demands that were made upon her to bring her into the palace. Mordecai as well is certainly compliant in informing against the plot to assassinate King Xerxes. And the diatribe, you notice, continues. These people are not doing anything to promote Xerxes' rule or his empire. And having then outlined what Haman considered the political and the social implications of allowing this certain people, as he calls them, to remain, he then turns to the Achilles' heel, the weak spot in Xerxes. He goes on to say, look, I am quite willing, if it pleases the king, verse 9, to let the decree be issued to destroy them, I will put 10,000 talents of silver into the royal treasury for the men who will carry out the business. It'll all be paid for. It won't come upon you, King Xerxes. Now, Haman knew, you see, that the two failed wars, we mentioned them before, two failed wars against the Greeks had been costly. Money was an issue. Wealth was an issue. The finance, the economy was an issue. As it always is with greater empires. The greater the empire, well, the more it takes to keep it going. And Haman seems either he was a very wealthy man. That's one interpretation. He offered near enough 2/3 of the whole Persian annual income. 10,000 talents. Herodotus says, in terms of the writing of history, that the whole of the economy of the Persian Empire at that time, 15,000 talents of silver or gold. Now, it either suggests he was a very wealthy man, a sort of a Mr. Trump of his day, no cost, makes no difference to me, I can pay it all. Or does it perhaps it suggest to us that here is a man who knew that were he to get this decree passed, were he to have these people destroyed, then all their possessions and all their wealth of this certain people would be collected and would be used, and not only perhaps to pay then those who were going to perpetrate this act, but to also as well to enrich himself, and perhaps some for Xerxes as well, because it had met his desire. And the king, without further investigation, you read there in verse 10, look, he took his signet ring from off his finger and he gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. And giving that signet ring, it was very much like saying, rubber stamping it. No investigation at all, no question, well, who are these certain people? Where's the proof? What's the history? What's the background? No, trusted him completely. Was Xerxes genuine in refusing the money? It seems, he says in verse 11, keep the money, the king said to Haman. Well, commentators point out that it was the Oriental custom to refuse the first offer of money, only to then to be offered it again the second time and then to receive it. It was the case of Abraham, when you think back when he was buying the plot of land to bury Sarah. In discussion with the Hamorites at the time, money was offered. Oh no, you can have it for nothing. But it's all the custom of offering and refusal, but then eventually you do pay. And then verses 12 to 15 sees the decree written out in the various languages of the province, and then the process of distributing that decree organized, very much like a parcel post, but making sure that it's going to be brought out to the 127 provinces of this great empire. And we notice that whether it's whatever language it is, the clear purpose is seen here. All are to be destroyed, young and old, and their possessions are to be plundered. Success to Haman and his ancestors over the sworn enemy of centuries past. Haman will succeed perhaps where his forebears failed. And Haman was very pleased with himself. And you notice the concluding verse 15. Very pleased with himself. He'd sold the idea to the king. The king had swallowed it, as we say, hook, line, and sinker. And Haman sat down to drink with Xerxes. Let's have a drink on it. Not at all moved by what had been agreed. Not thinking about the implications and the effect that would have upon so many individuals. But the citizens of Susa, we read, they were bewildered, befuddled, confused. Why had this been done? And if the king could change towards this people, well, might he not change towards us? What's going on there? Now, practically, let's draw some conclusions. Firstly, we can say that promotions are not always a good thing. Prominence should be for the benefit of all, not for personal advantage. And that's perhaps why those around him in the courtyard, the other nobles, they knew what Haman was like. But he weaseled his way in then. So be careful, just because you have people in positions of prominence and significance, you think, well, they must be men of integrity. She must be a woman of credibility. You could depend on her. I mean, the phone call. Look at the paperwork. Look at the business that they're representing. Look at the telephone numbers. Look at the people who've endorsed it. They must be genuine. Beware. Beware. Secondly, we must always be on our guard against the speeches of men. We're going to be hearing a lot of speeches in the months to come. A lot of speeches with regards to the way forward for not only our nation, but for the United Kingdom. We need to be on our guard against the speeches of men who have an underlying motive for their actions. Are they seriously just talking about the issue? Or are they already thinking, well, what will happen after it? Who's going to be in the position of influence and prominence after it? Because we know that somebody's not going to remain forever. He's told us he's going. So we've got to position ourselves. How best can I secure the votes for the future? And so I'll say anything, I'll do anything to secure that. We must be on our guard against the speeches of men. The men's hearts are deep and also perhaps almost imponderable as far as what they intend to do. And then we must also be prepared to look into things before we give our consent. That was certainly Xerxes' failure. Didn't go into the details. He took it for granted. He took it on the surface. But also as well, we need to see also this conflict that exists between good and evil, between God's people and those who would seek to oppose him. But we come back always to that final point. God is on the throne. God will rule. God reigns. And he will accomplish his purposes. So there we have then the four characters displayed. The plot is in motion. And we'll consider then in future the plan of Mordecai and then the pleas of Esther to bring this to a conclusion.